Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. What do you eat in a typical day? Some of us have figured that out with a nutritionist to plan weight loss or muscle-building diets. Most of us just eat, though, what our mothers taught us, what our friends show us, whatever is in the machine, in the break room, or for sale on the street. The new book, What I Eat, Around the World in 80 Diets, by photographer Peter Menzel and writer Faith DeLucio, takes that question to a whole new level. Deconstructing a typical day's diet for 80 people from around the world, from an Inuit to a steelworker. They're with us today. Peter is an award-winning photojournalist whose work has been published in Time, National Geographic, and Smithsonian, among others. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you very much.
And also Faith. She's a former television news producer and writer of their previous books, including Hungry Planet, What the World Eats. Welcome to the show, Faith.
Hi, thanks.
The book is beautiful. It's big and it's fat, and I love those kind of books.
It's really heavy to carry around, though.
And I've been lugging it around.
It can actually be an exercise book. It weighs 5 pounds, so raise it over your head 20 times a day.
Good point. It's much more than pictures and profiles of individuals and their diets. It includes a series of essays as well, dealing with the issues surrounding food consumption, and one of them talks about how cooking makes us human. It's something that connects all of us to each other.
It does, and it explains why humans evolved the way they did and what our digestive system has turned into.
It was written by Richard Wrangham,
who's an expert on this, who spent his whole life studying this and has actually lived in Africa with chimpanzees and observed their diet. What he discovered was that cooking just really makes food more digestible. It increases the amount of calories, and our bodies just aren't really adapted to eating raw food. I don't know if you've ever tried to eat rice that isn't cooked.
Well, probably if someone's cooked it poorly. So what about that cultural act of cooking? Any impressions about that in your travels?
Oh, gosh. Every single place we go, even if we weren't doing a Food About book, no matter where we go, the very first thing you do to get to know people is to, in essence, break bread with them. And that's really how all of our conversations start anyway, even if we're sitting down first with our journalist friends or we're meeting with a translator. Generally, you're doing it over a meal. And it's really the introduction to every culture. Why are we eating this way, this place? Generally, in the past at least, it's been because of geography, economic ability to pay for whatever it is that we're eating, what's growing around. That's changing as we eat more and more from the global marketplace, certainly in this country, but also throughout the developed world and the developing world. We're seeing more and more of our highly processed food in places where there may not even have yet achieved adequate nutrition, and they're sort of jumping right over that into highly processed foods, which aren't necessarily a good thing.
I guess the most shocking diet, since you brought it up, that I read about in the book was, I'm not sure I'll pronounce his name right, Tercium Bazudenhout, the Trans-Kalahari Trucker.
Sure.
Tell us about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. But, a lot of his diet is quite literal. His was one of the easiest to calculate because what we did in this book was we ranked the book from lowest to highest calories.
Right.
And what we decided to do was Peter wanted to do a driver on the Trans-Kalahari Highway. So we found one on the border between Namibia and Botswana, and this was Terry, who is a Namibian, and he basically eats on the road. He buys all of his food at a big box store in South Africa, and then they don't stop. They don't have the kind of rules that we have on our highways, and the ones they do have, they generally flout to get from point A to point B. So he's eating boxed food largely. He'll stop once in the morning and make usually like a pasta with some canned meat of some sort, and then he'll eat that cold the rest of the day, and a lot of packaged food. But he was one of the easiest people for us to calculate because it is so packaged.
And he's over 8,000 calories.
Yeah, exactly. It was amazing. At the start of the book, there are some pages devoted to the collective wisdom about eating from all sorts of people, from Jane Goodall to Amy Tan. And I was wondering, how did you decide to include who to include in this section, and what did you ask them to write about? What was the question that they were answering, or the prompt?
Basically, what Peter had decided early on was that is to sort of open up the foreword to a lot of different people. And generally, all of our books are always about average people and what they do typically. And we thought it might be interesting to include some just different people from different walks of life, you know, people who are foodies, people who are not, some people from the distant past who are still with us and still eating interesting diets like Jack LaLanne, and
yeah.
So which was great fun, you know, guy right out of the 60s who that was actually one of Peter's most favorite responses in the front of the book. But Peter, how did you gather these?
Well, I just took a, you know, I made a wish list of people that, as Faith was mentioning, foodies and writers. I mean, Frank Bruni and Dan Barber, a great chef.
Great.
Ferran Adrià, who we spent some time with in Spain, who's one of the world's most famous chefs. Corby Cummers, a terrific writer. And then people like Francis Ford Coppola and T. Colin Campbell and Jane Goodall.
The question I asked was,
what would you share with people about your own daily diets? What have you learned?
Okay.
And we had some people, though, who responded sort of in some, you know, in a rather more sweeping fashion. And so Peter then had to go back and say no about your diet. And, you know, and so Tim Cahill, you know, who is the founding editor of Outside Magazine and a good friend of Peter's, says, you know, often you don't know if the chicken head floating in the soup is reserved for the honored guest or is a joke on you.
Right.
Best to assume the former. Just little interesting tidbits like this.
Yeah, and Peter, you highlighted notions in each of them.
Exactly. Yeah, the Faith was mentioning the quote from the bodybuilder that we used to see on TV in black and white. Jack LaLanne,
yeah.
He actually came up with a story about how when he was a teenager, he used to go to an Oakland slaughterhouse and get a quart of blood that because he read about the Maasai drinking blood, making them strong. So he did this for a couple of months until he actually choked on a blood clot and gave it up. And then he talks about what makes him strong still today, and that's not having any sweets and still working out.
It's funny. I thought I'd read. Oh, no, I guess I just missed that one. I didn't read them all, but.
One I would have liked to have missed.
Except thanks, that I'm a child of Jack LaLanne, not literally, but figuratively. I grew up with him doing the little, you know, exercises, whatever he did.
Oh, yeah.
Standing by the chair.
Yeah, exactly. I love the one that some people were sort of literal. Hendrik Hertzberg, senior editor of The New Yorker and author of Obaminos, The Birth of a New Political Era. He wrote about, my favorite food, bar none, is Brussels sprouts.
He's so brave to put that out there because, you know, that's a love-hate thing for so many people. Mm-hmm. They either really like them or they really don't, and he really likes them.
And then, you know, very little, or he gets right down to the, while I'm cooking, a martini is nice, and, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. I was surprised Francis Coppola doesn't drink a lot.
He's looking at the calories.
Yeah, he's spending a lot more time these days, I think, looking at that. But he was an interesting guy just because when, you know, he basically delivered a film script when we asked him for a little quote. And it was, so it was an interesting process to go through with him. I mean, he's, you know, just so incredibly wildly creative that, and he isn't with his food as well. You know, the fact that vegetables are a free pass, I just thought that was kind of a fun thing that he said, you know.
Yeah.
But that now, it, you know, lemon juice is the preferred dressing. In the past, it would have been a lot more olive oil.
Right.
And, you know, because he's trying, like all of us, to moderate as we get older.
My guests are Peter Menzel, photojournalist, and Faith DeLucio, writer, authors together of the book What I Eat, Around the World in 80 Diets. If you have a question or comment, don't hesitate to call us, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, Twitter us at Ann Fisher WOSU, or All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. You can do it there, too. In each short, I remember Hungry Planet, What the World Eats, very well. I love the book. It was portraits of families posed with a week's worth of food.
Sure, and it was basically, though, it was based more on the economics, you know, and
okay.
what does a week's worth of food look like? And it was actually during that book that Peter started thinking how interesting it might be to look at individuals. You know, okay, this is what a week's worth looks like for an entire family.
And what it costs.
Mm-hmm. And what it costs. He started getting interested in calories and, you know, being the photographer, you know, it's easier for him. He can sort of, you know, obviously he's part and parcel of the entire project, but someone had to actually do the calculation. So he gets these grand ideas, and then somebody's got to execute all the little minutiae of life, and that would be my job.
I was wondering, because I, you know, you made the point earlier about tertium, you know, it was easy because you just had to look at the can in the back of the packages to work it out. How did you do it?
Well, it was tough. You know, basically what we had to do is figure out what were the metrics. And we're really lucky because we've got, you know, Marion Nessel is a big supporter of our work, the nutritionist at NYU, and not just the nutritionist. You know, she's just a really great thinker when it comes to food. So she was a really great early resource.
She was just on our show yesterday.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you couldn't have a better guest. And I'd like to call her just to hear her talk. I don't even have to say a word. And she's pretty amazing. But, you know, so basically what we did, though, was we had to figure out, again, what is the metric for all of this? Mm-hmm. And so before we ever went out the door, we started calculating our own food. And we travel with an electronic scale, actually several different ones in case the first one breaks, which did happen. And you really haven't lived until you've brought an electronic scale into a yak herder's tent in the Tibetan Plateau. It was very popular. Everybody had to try it out for about half a day first. But, you know, so I didn't work alone in this. Obviously, we had people on the staff who were working on it, but we had to figure out what exactly we were calculating. And so we had to know, you know, okay, bring measuring cups, measuring spoons, all that sort of thing. But then also later on, once we had what it was that we were tallying, who was going to do the tallying, and that we found two nutritionists at UC Davis. And they helped us basically come up with the calorie counts.
And the book is arranged by calorie counts, right, from the least to the most. And we did weigh every parcel of food from everybody's diet, from, you know, the Maasai herder's wife, Nuku Sirani, to Jill McTighe in Great Britain, who was eating quite a bit that day.
Yeah, I want to talk about her later. We have to take a quick break right now. My guest, Peter Menzel, photojournalist, Faith DeLucio, writer. They together produced What I Eat Around the World in 80 Diets. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And remember, a sustaining membership is one that automatically renews. Give $20, $50, or $100 a month and show your continuous support for WOSU. Just go to WOSU.org/sustainer and thank you for your support of WOSU Public Media.
Support for WOSU comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. CCAD offers continuing education classes where you can update your creative career skills. Classes start September 13th. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Cloudy skies, a slight chance of rain, and a high of 80 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 57. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 75. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are Peter Menzel and Faith DeLucio, who together produced the book What I Eat Around the World in 80 Diets. Questions or comments about the book or Peter and Faith, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned in the introduction that most people tell you what they think you want to hear. How did you make up for that tendency?
Well, I think what I actually said is that sometimes that happens.
Okay.
And so, as you know, as a journalist, we all have to gauge what it is that we're being told, mm-hmm, against the larger culture, against neighbors. Sometimes I even we'll query children, and re-questioning helps a lot. If someone tells you one thing and then you ask them about it, you know, later that day or the next day and it doesn't jive, well, then you go back and you're redoing the work. And so, you know, I think largely we're very representative here. I think a really important point that we try always to make, I certainly make it in the introduction, probably ad nauseum, is the fact that what we didn't do was we did not cover a daily caloric average. We decided against, pretty early on, against doing that, because once you start trying to depict an average, the food stops looking like anything. It's easier to do in places in the developing world where they're eating the same thing from day to day. So a lot of these people could, in fact, be construed as an average. But, for example, if you look at the higher end of the scale, people who are not working physically hard, if they're eating, you know, over, like the U.S., you know, recommended daily calorie count is about 2,000, depending on what, the size of the individual, all that sort of thing, male, female. But if you're eating on the higher end of the scale, if you're eating 4,000 or 5,000 calories a day and you're not expending, you know, you're not exercising, you're not working physically hard, you can't. That's not sustainable. You're just going to get, you know, giant, and even with a great metabolism, you're going to start gaining weight. So what we decided to do was really focus on a day. And I largely started with, what did you eat yesterday, and was it typical? Someone like Jill McTighe, who we call the snacker mom in Great Britain, she was at the time a binge eater, and binging can be, you know, it's very destructive over time. It's something that everybody works on, and she was very, very honest. We calculated her calories, and it was over 12,000 calories for that day.
Wow.
And so, you know, other days, though, as I say in the introduction, you know, she would have been more moderate, maybe 5,000, maybe even 2,000. Actually, at that time, probably barely 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd gone from like a size 8 to a size 14 or a size 16 pretty quickly, and was working her way back down. She's one of the few that we actually included a postscript.
Right.
I thought it was really instructive to revisit her, in an interview, not pictorially, but in the interview, just to sort of see how she was doing, because I really felt like it was one of the stories that really made me want to go back and know, you know, okay, so how is she now?
Yeah, I was glad you did it too, because, of course, in her story, one of the reasons why she was binging so much is she was trying to, she's a drug addict.
Exactly. And she was trying, she had cut back almost completely on the drugs at the time. Interestingly, she did tell us that she, after we had come there, and we find this a lot, people never really see all their days' worth of food, or in the case of Hungry Planet, their entire week's worth of food at one time. It's shocking for some people, sad for others, and some people don't really have that much of an opinion about it, but generally the ones who are shocked by it change their diet, and that's really what Jill did. You know, we don't go in there trying to change people.
Sure.
What we're trying to do is really provide our readers with the opportunity to see the world, which is something that we certainly do, and we try to show what we've seen, but also to compare and contrast each other, themselves. You know, a lot of these people, I think we have, how many Americans do we have in here?
There's 20 Americans.
20 Americans. You know, we try to be as representative as possible, people-wise, across, you know, the country. We can't hit everywhere, so we tried to just have, you know, people from all different walks of life. So, you know, we've got Tiffany Whitehead, for example, who was, we found her at, a staffer at the Mall of America amusement park, and at the time her diet was very fast food oriented, because she was spending, you know, she was a student and she goes out with her friends, so they may eat differently, but generally very, very fast food. And she's very trim, beautiful girl. It was funny, talked to her recently. She had just seen coverage of her picture in the latest issue of Marie Claire magazine. They had excerpted some of the women. And she said, well, you know, I eat differently now. And I said, everybody does. No one stays.
It was bad, though. I couldn't believe it was just 1,900 calories.
Well, but you know what? You can, and I think it's been proven, you can actually eat fewer calories. I think the quality of calories then comes into play.
Right, which explains the value or how some of the folks with such low-calorie diets survive.
That's true. But also you've got, you know, someone like we have Rick Bumgardner in here who is, you know, was almost 500 pounds when we met him.
Right.
And he was eating a very low-calorie diet because he's trying to qualify for weight loss surgery.
Which he just qualified for. He's down to 400 now.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I was going to ask you about him.
Yeah, we just actually heard from him yesterday. He's they're getting ready to do the surgery. But when we first covered him, he was really struggling. And we decided that we would include him but not do what he ate to get to that weight. We really wanted to show, you know, what he looks like. And he's a very, very large man.
Mm-hmm.
In the picture, and to, you know, to just do his diet, what he was calling rabbit food, and you know, 1,600 calories, and he was cheating a lot, which is why it was taking him such a long time to lose. He had to lose, I think, 100 pounds in order to even qualify for the gastric surgery.
It was pretty amazing when he said he gained about 100 pounds in a year, though, from his job.
Yeah, well, he was, you know, driving around, and he was a milkman for a while, and he would trade ice cream in every single school cafeteria he would deliver to. They would feed him, and he never turned down food. He's also a very social guy, and a lot of times, you know, very social people, that's, you know, a great way to be social is to eat with other people. So he was eating with many people all day.
The profiles reveal similarities as well as extreme differences in diet. Did any of the similarities surprise you?
Oh, I don't know. You know, because we covered so many people for this book, this was such a hard book to do, even though the profiles are shorter than we did for Hungry Planet. There are so many people. You know, I think that some of the interesting similarities are some of the more unfortunate ones, which are largely that highly processed food is really finding its way into so many diets. You know, if you look, for example, at our Venezuelan student, Catherine Nava, she's eating about 4,000 calories on the, at the time that we talked to her. And she's in a barrio in Caracas. And she'd actually lived in the United States for a year. And when she came back, she said her mother didn't recognize her. She said, "You know, our mom's very trim." We met her mom, and she said, "You're so fat," is what she told her.
Fast food in New York got her.
It was fast food in New York. But then when she came back, she really didn't stop it. And she does eat a lot of chips and candy. But she's also eating traditional food, and she was trying at the time we met her. She was really trying to cut back. And plus being around her mom was sort of really nagging her the entire time. So I don't know if she was sort of fighting against that or what, but, you know, 4,000 calories for someone who really isn't physically active, although she was, I think, playing basketball at the time, that's a lot of calories.
Now, there's the teenager at the weight loss camp, too,
who
was interesting to me.
She was, you know why she was interesting to us? It was interesting to go to a weight loss camp because we'd never been to one. And
which is a big business.
Which is a huge business. But this place, you know, I was impressed by how active they were making everybody be, which you would sort of expect. But you know, the cafeteria was sort of like a lockdown. You only got a certain amount, and there were no seconds, of course. But the kids, you know, all of course, every kid in every camp is going to have something to say about the food. But nobody had that, you know, that great of a thing to say about the food. But she was interesting because of how frank she was about how she cheats. And how she cheats at home, and what she wished her parents would help her do at home, and she wished it were more like that. But there was a locked cabinet at home, and she figured she found the key. You know, she got her parents to lock up the food, but then she figured out where they kept the key by process of elimination, and then she was cheating again. You know, it was almost like a game for her.
Mm-hmm.
But she's also a really active girl and a really good athlete.
Yeah.
But she's also
300 pounds.
She's very heavy, 300 pounds. But she says she doesn't, you know, and she's very tall. But she says she doesn't want to weigh any less than 180 because she doesn't feel comfortable, you know, at a lower weight. And because she is such a big girl, you know, pretty big boned, and that's where she feels comfortable. But she says she doesn't feel fat or look, she doesn't even think she looks that fat until she looks in the mirror, you know. But she says, when I'm just walking, I'm just like anybody else.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Peter, how did you decide which countries, which professions, which people to include in the book? Because there are some actually famous people. I mean, I put Joel Salatin up there in the famous category. He's our
only really famous person, though. And we did him actually almost before he was really getting really, really famous. Mm. He hadn't been in Food, Inc.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he's an amazing guy.
But we decided we've been traveling for quite a few years ourselves, and having worked in over 50 countries, we picked a few countries that we hadn't been to, like Iran and Yemen. And we'd never been to the Amazon, so we did the interior of Brazil, did a couple of people there, a fisherman and a farm rancher's wife. So we went to places that we hadn't been before and that we had real interest in. One of the things that we did, too, is compare and contrast people that have the same occupations or the same lifestyle. For instance, in Africa, we did two herders, two women, one in Kenya, a Maasai woman, and one in Namibia on the Angola border, a Himba woman. And it was really interesting because of the amount of food that they were eating. One was in drought and the other was in the rainy season where the cows were producing everything and the corn was being harvested. And the Himba woman was very healthy and doing very well. And Nukusaruni in Kenya, the Maasai herder, was only eating 800 calories a day because it was in drought.
But in the next week, when they would eat a goat, then her calorie count would have gone higher. So as I was saying earlier, because we were covering, you know, a certain day, and what I did was I used the story to basically outline the fact that, you know, if they had been eating a goat, the calorie count would be higher. Because, again, that's all instructive. You know, we are not our calorie counts, and that was the one thing I worried about with this book, is that people would look at this and go, oh, you know, forevermore they're labeled as this weight or this, you know, this particular. It's a snapshot in time. Each one of these is really a moving target.
Yeah, like the yak herder in Tibet or the monk in Tibet, a priest in Rome who eats very, very well compared to, you know, a Hindu priest in India who's begging for his food, who's eating quite a bit less.
Who chooses to.
He chooses to, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, he actually turned down. We had offered him some more food just because we were in a situation where we could at that moment, and he turned it down and said, no, I only need this and doesn't want any more.
And then we did very low-tech people like a rickshaw driver in India, and then very high-tech, an astronaut circling the globe.
Peter didn't shoot that one, though. They wouldn't let him go up there. But it was interesting. He had a lot of fun because he was in email contact with them, and he helped them to develop the shot. He was sending them pictures of
drawings of things, how I would like the picture to
Where the food would go.
It turned out really well. The space shuttle commander shot the picture, and
you don't see any of the hands in the shot, but there were a lot of people who, all the other astronauts, they took a little bit of time and helped us out and got the food in the right places and then pulled their hands out of the shot, and then he took the shot.
It reminded me of, like, you know, remember in the 60s and 70s, the space food sticks and Tang.
The
and
food has really, really evolved. They're eating pretty well.
Yeah, I remember those space food sticks. Oh, they were really disgusting.
My dad had a hang-up. He loved those things, and I don't know, you know. It was like that was our snack of the decade, it felt
they
like.
They were pretty gross.
It was bad.
Washed down with Tang.
Right. Exactly. We have an email now. If you'd like to email us, allsides@wosu.org will do the trick. This email is from Paul. He says it's on a different but related subject. First, what's your experience on American restaurants and groceries? There seem to be few restaurants and stores that actually sell authentic recipes and ingredients from other countries, most notably Mexican and Chinese. The Mexican we usually see is slathered with cheese, while the authentic stuff usually has none.
Well, food is customized according to where the restaurant is. For instance, in Tennessee, we went to the opening of a Japanese restaurant and ordered a maki California roll, which was made with mayonnaise, which was terrifying.
It was actually a sweet. It was like Miracle Whip, I think. It was like a sweet mayonnaise, and it was really funny to see Peter's face. Well, and these were, you know, guys that were from Japan, and, you know, we've been to Japan a number of times.
But they were trying to please their...
Well, they were trying,
to please the local
constituency, right.
And what we find in restaurants in America is that portion size seems to be
out
very,
of control.
Very important. And probably that's why doggy bags maybe weren't very popular in Europe, because they were serving reasonable-sized meals that people would finish in the restaurant.
But yeah, actually, though, even there now, you're seeing larger portion sizes. I mean, Peter and I, when we go to a restaurant, we are eating. We usually get one meal, and if we do get two, but then we bring it home. We're bringing most a lot of it home with us. But I think Paul's exactly right. What you find is that, you know, food is tailored in this country to the American taste. Americans really have a taste for, you know, sort of extreme flavors in terms of like a very sweet, more salty. And again, that's a broad sweeping generalization, mm-hmm. because just, you know, there are a lot of people who Americans who know what they're eating and do have a good idea about what is good food and authentic food. So, quite frankly, there are so many chains in this country, and that's really something mm-hmm. that we try to avoid. Mm-hmm. But there are a few good ones like Chipotle, where, you know, they're not really doing authentic anything other than they're just doing good, you know, honest, you know, tasty food that's, you know, lightly salted and spiced well. Sort of like Mexican, but not really.
Yeah, well, it was in some you know, readers poll or something in Columbus recently. It was named like people's favorite Mexican restaurants. And I just kind of wanted to tear my hair out because I like Chipotle too, but I don't think of it as Mexican.
I don't either.
I was lucky enough to eat in some 5-star restaurants in Mexico City some years back. And wow, I mean, it's just completely. But there is also a lot of what we think of as traditional Mexican in the United States. You can get that there too.
Oh, sure. Definitely. And, you know, I do think, you know, Paul's right that mm-hmm. he, like you, is probably tearing his hair out when people are calling something, one thing when it's obviously something else. But that's true. Even if you go and have Chinese food in Africa, you're going to get a very interesting food. It's not going to really be like food we would get in China, and it's not going to be food like we get in the U.S. because it's, you know, tailored more to local tastes. Although, if you go to where, like, there, in fact, when we were in Windhoek in Namibia, they have a huge, really surprisingly huge Chinese population, a lot of merchants. When they cook for each other in places that they would, you know, that immigrants there would be eating at, then you're going to find, you know, that it's more similar to what we would find in China. But places that are frequented by everybody else, you know, much less so.
I was surprised, and I'm pretty sure I read it in your book, sometimes I can't, about that Wendy's didn't make it in Japan.
Right. They closed down a couple of years ago. They just couldn't seem to compete against McDonald's and some of the other bigger chains.
There are some, though. Japan is an interesting place just in terms of food, largely because they have really such an incredible history of good, nutritious food, low-calorie, nutritious food. But places like Okinawa, where the American military went into, have had fast food first. So the centenarians, you know, way back when, and the ones that are still around, their children and their grandchildren are actually are much less healthy now because of the food that they're eating. But the other thing about Japan is that there is competition from Japanese fast food restaurants. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the names of these. There are a few, but they're actually it's a little almost like Chipotle in that they're just, you know, doing really good healthy food, mm-hmm. and that's giving everybody a run for their money.
We have to take another break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Peter Menzel and Faith DeLuzio, writers. Peter's a photographer of What I Eat Around the World in 80 Diets. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, the collision of Christianity and Islam in the area about 700 miles north of the equator. We talk with Eliza Griswold about her new book, The Tenth Parallel. And Jeff Charlotte, author of the bestseller, The Family, and the forthcoming book, C Street, talks about his trip to Uganda to meet David Bahati, who introduced the draconian anti-gay bill into Parliament. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And at WOSU, listener feedback is very important. Your thoughts on the conversation some of us have been having across the radio and web matter a lot to us. We're creating an online audience advisory panel, and we're looking for at least 1,000 listeners who can help. If you have a moment, please go to wosu.org/survey to sign up and send us your thoughts. That's wosu.org/survey. And it's 75 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:41. Cloudy skies today, a high near 80 degrees. There is a slight chance of rain. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 57 degrees. Sunny for Thursday and a high of 75. And Thursday night, clear skies, a low of 52. Looking ahead to Friday, sunny skies and a high of 78. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests, Pete Menzel and Faith DeLucio, they wrote and produced What I Eat Around the World in 80 Diets. Peter, I thought of you. The photography is wonderful, of course. Very colorful. That has to be an attractive thing for you.
Sure. I mean, everybody everywhere, we try to make them look as good as possible and put them in an interesting place. For instance, Chen Zhen in China, mm-hmm. the young student who's been seduced into eating some KFC several times a week. We took her out on Nanjing Road East in Shanghai at dusk when all the lights were really nice in the background, and you could see a KFC there in the background. And put her food on a tray, and it's really, really colorful. We did this practically everywhere. The bullfighter in Spain in a bull ring, mm-hmm. or the Conrad Tolby, the long-distance truck driver in the United States at dawn, in a truck stop with all the other trucks lined up.
We seem to do everything early and late.
Well, the light is better.
I think so, you know, as a writer, I don't really have to write in good light. So, right. You know, the fact that Peter and I are married and we've been together for, you know, traveling the world and doing these things for 17 or 18 years, I think I've seen every sunrise and sunset, and I'm a little tired of them.
You're a good sport, Faith, I have to say. Clearly, I mean, sunrise and sunsets are beautiful. We have another email from Paul. What do you think of Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations series as being representations of local foods?
I think Anthony Bourdain is hysterical. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of representations, I tend to think, unfortunately, and I'll probably get dinged for this, but I just think most television representations are sort of caricatures. And I'm, as a former television news producer, I think I have a little bit of ground to stand on there because I used to do a lot of representation of my own. But I think he's interesting. I think his books are interesting. And I think that contextually, you know, I hope that the people watching it have traveled a little or have seen other things, you know, National Geographic Channel, whatever.
I've never seen it. I only listen to NPR.
Oh, very good answer, Peter. Did the experience... Well, I'm wondering what felt most foreign to you. Anything after all these years of traveling like you have?
You know, sometimes it's the location itself. When we were in Yemen, you know, Sana'a is probably the most beautiful capital city on the planet. It's also probably
the most threatened
and the least tourist visited for very good reasons. You know, it's not a particularly safe place, mm-hmm. Especially for Americans, but really for anybody. What was interesting was sort of peeling back the layers there into society, and we were quite fortunate in the people that we met there and our translator there, Sami El Sayani, and another woman there too, Carolyn, who is living there, is a British woman, a Scottish woman who's living there.
Right, so we did three people in Yemen. One was a cot seller because cot, the drug, is so important in Yemeni society.
But it's also a problem crop because people use it to get high all the time.
And what is this called?
It's called cot.
Q-A-T.
Q-A-T is one of the transliterations. But it is it's a mild, it's a herbal... What would you call it?
It's like you get a caffeine buzz from chewing.
Is this the stuff that they're selling in the United States, or they're trying to? And
yeah, the problem is that it deteriorates really quickly, so you have to fly it in. It's fresh, so within 24 hours,
it's not legal in the United States. What's happening there, though, is that they have so little water in Yemen, and most of it's going to water this crop, and so it's not a food crop. But it is a pleasure crop, and it's almost everybody does it. It's like what you do on a Friday afternoon. You get together, and that's what you do. But so it's decimating, it's really decimating the countryside because everything is either a cot orchard or a desert, and they're having to fly in all their food, and this is a very poor country. But the other two people we did there, was one guy who's actually going to be on our website. We didn't include him in the book just because we ran out of room.
He was a dagger salesman.
Yeah, he sells daggers in the marketplace there, and he's a very entertaining guy who eats something. One of my most favorite foods that we found that was new was called Girl of the Plate, and it's this amazing honey on bread concoction that I've never tasted anything like it, and I'm going to put the recipe on our website whatieat.org.
Okay.
Not up yet, but it will be.
Okay, I was going to ask you. I looked for something,
yeah,
but I didn't find anything.
We're late. The book took so long, it took so much out of us, that now we're really late with the website, but it'll be good once it's up there.
By this time next week, it should be up.
Then the other person that we did is the covered woman in the book, and that's an interesting picture, and because she's completely covered in black. And
you only see her eyes.
You only see her eyes, and that's her day's worth of food. And that was hard to get. That picture was, we almost didn't get anyone because nobody would agree. And we, went in there sort of thinking we were going to have trouble. And we didn't have a female translator to go into this family to help us because they just couldn't, they weren't allowed to, by their family to go in. So we had to use the male translator we were using. But at that point, then you have to find a man who is willing to allow his wife to be photographed and for the wife herself to be photographed, because it's a very patriarchal society.
Right.
And so, regular average folk, just not ever done. So it was very difficult to get. And then once you get in there, our translator could not talk directly to her.
Mm-hmm.
So everything had, I was asking the question. My translator was asking the husband. The husband was asking the wife. The wife was telling the husband. The husband was telling Sammy, our translator, and then it came back to me. So it took about 15 minutes back and forth for one question. But we finally got what Peter made, a great picture and really great data and an interesting story.
You were determined to get a woman for that. What dictated that? What kind of balance were you looking for?
Well, I'm always fighting to show women in all of our work, and Peter's pretty good about that as well, generally. I wouldn't say completely, but generally. And I think the balance to me is still a little bit off here in that we've got, I think, 24 women in the book, and there are 80 people in the book. In the developing world, it's actually really difficult to get regular folk to get the, women are actually way too busy to really spend a lot of time with us. And I can give you an example. In Tibet, we really wanted to cover on the Tibetan plateau, we wanted to cover this woman we found, Porbu, who was a yak herder's wife. And she was so busy, and she just never stopped moving the entire day. She'd have her hands in yak dung, making dung cakes that would then she'd be burning inside. She'd make, she was milking. She was making all the family's food, and she was, chasing yaks and zoes around and babies and taking care of her kids.
Her husband, on the other hand.
Her husband was a little bit kicked back. No, Now, he also worked hard.
Yeah, he was a hard worker.
He's a hard worker, and he admitted that. But when I asked if she would do it, she said, I'm too shy, you know. And I think it was more she was too busy, and so we ended up doing her husband.
Yeah.
But the entire story, I think you can tell if you read the story in the book, it's mostly about her.
Yeah. Well, I appreciated the yak dung stacked up in the tent behind him.
It's, you know, that
duly noted.
Oh, my God. It's one of the most amazing tents I've ever been in.
Yeah. Did the experience inspire you to change any of your habits?
Yes. Faith mentioned that we did weigh our own food for a couple of weeks and really paid attention to it. And, you know, certain realizations like the fact that there's 120 calories in a teaspoon of oil. Tablespoon of oil made us.
And it's actually 116 to 120 calories, depending on the oil.
made us really take a look at our diets. But we also, you know, understood more thoroughly, and that's what we wanted. We want our readers to do, to understand that food is fuel, and that you know, if you're putting a certain amount in your body, if you don't burn it every day, it's going to end up as excess that will end up as extra body weight in one form or another. So, you know, just paying attention to how we eat, which from our garden in the summertime is really good, and you know, watching portion size, being moderate.
Moderation was really the key, I think.
And then motion. Mm-hmm. Motion is terrifically important, and we confessed at the end of the book and the afterword, too, that Faith and I both, during the last few months of the book, were very inactive because we were chained to our computer for probably 16 hours a day. We both gained some weight that we hadn't really changed our diet, but we gained weight because we weren't as physically active. So when you are less physically active, you sort of have to pay more attention.
I was reading about the oil last night, and I just made my version of mala string beans, and I was like, oh, crap. So I worked out extra hard this morning, and I get it completely. I was wondering, there was a couple different stories in the book that I was touched by, and of course one was the homeless and abandoned boy in Bangladesh, and I wondered how you found somebody like him, and was it as easy as just walking up to him? How did you decide on him? Because there's so many kids like him there. What struck you about him?
Well, we were looking in Bangladesh. We wanted to, you know, we photographed several people, but one of them I targeted. I wanted to photograph someone that was sleeping on the street because so many people are homeless and sleeping on the street. Mm-hmm. So we went to the train station where a lot of people in the front of the train station are sleeping, and we were walking through the station before dawn, and Alamin just came up to us, and we started talking to him, and we're just taken by him.
And he was working, you know. So
a 12-year-old.
Basically, he was working as an unofficial porter. So we watched him for a while, you know, basically fight with a bunch of other boys to carry, you know, a few bags for people for some pocket change, so that pocket change then would translate into meals for him. And he was interesting to me because he was eating better on his own than he had been up at home.
Earning a dollar a day, he was able to eat better than he was at home.
Yeah.
Did you get a sense about what his future is, though, someone like him?
You know, we had our translator call his mother, and she actually didn't have a phone. We had to call a neighbor who then ran over to get the mother, and, you know, it took a while. But we finally, because, A, you know, we wanted to check the story, and, B, we just wanted to know what was true, what was not so true. And it turned out that everything he had told us was true. He was, I think, when last we found out, he was going to be heading back home, that he had decided that he would go back there. But, you know, basically it was kind of a troubled situation because the dad had left the family, had moved off, and they no longer had enough to eat. Were being supported by the grandmother, and the dad had now started another family. So then Alamin had gone to try and find this other family, you know, and we got all of this from Alamin, but then also confirmed by his mom. You know, in terms of future, again, you know, each of these is a snapshot in time. Mm-hmm. Everybody's life moves on. You know, we learn a lot about circumstances after the fact. And, you know, I do know that he did go home. Whether he stayed home, I don't know that.
You had him. You had the teenager at the weight loss camp. How many other children did you have in the book?
Oh, let's see. We've got Coco in at the time. And she's in Canada. And
she was a vegetarian.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yes.
At the time, she was. We had a miniaturist's daughter in Arafa Fotowat in Iran, who was just still in her teens and just graduating from high school.
She was interesting because she wanted to be, her career choice was a fashion designer. So she was looking a lot on the internet of fashions, Paris fashions, which would never be accepted in Iran.
Well, it is accepted in Iran, except that it's only accepted behind closed doors. And,
right.
You know, it's. I went to a wedding there. It was fascinating. And anyone who could should, because you're on the street, everybody's covered, you know, very well. It's mandated that you're covered, you know, very discreetly. But then behind closed doors, you know, you go to a wedding, all the women celebrate by themselves and the men celebrate by themselves. The women are decked out like you wouldn't believe. And it was fascinating. But no pictures, unfortunately.
You know, I glanced at that one. I didn't have a chance to read it. What's a miniaturist?
A miniaturist is quite literally a painter who is doing these very, very small paintings. And
okay.
They're beautiful.
He's doing it on elephant bone.
Okay.
Or camel bone.
You know, obviously, I didn't have a chance to read the entire book. I will. But it definitely is like a coffee table book.
Well, we hope it sits on a lot of coffee tables mm-hmm. because we get absolutely no sponsorship. We basically bet the farm every time we do our books, and we stay independent that way. But it also means a lot of sleepless nights and a lot of worry.
You did this over the course of 3 years.
Yep.
So did you go back and forth from home out? And your travels, or did you just plow
ahead? We try not to be away for more than a month at a time,
okay.
just because we have so much going on. So we don't just go and stay out. But, you know, as all our translators know, once they meet us, they're never shot of us, because it takes so much to do this kind of coverage. You know, if you're working on recipes or whatever, you've got to go back and back and back. So email has certainly made that a lot easier.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about this recipe issue. You're going to have a website up, whateieat.org, right?
Mm-hmm. And I'm planning.
I'm
planning on putting some recipes up there. We don't have them for everybody, but mm-hmm. ones that are the most interesting. And we're not going to include everybody in the book because we'd like people to buy the book. But we are going to include some of the people that didn't make it into the book just because of space. We actually did – this project started as something called Nutrition 101, but we couldn't fit 101 people in there. So then it became Around the World in 80 Diets. And we're going to have these extra people also be on the website.
But there's so many other pictures and stories for the people that are actually in the book, too, that we're going to include some of those on the website.
So if you're looking at, you know, you're actually going to be able to see, you know, Mackenzie Wolfson at the weight loss camp. You're going to be able to see her exercising on video and see more pictures of her workouts, that sort of thing. So basically, if you buy the book, then there's a little bit of added value on the website.
Well, if you buy the book, it's a lot of beautiful pictures, Peter, and lots of great essays and writing, Faith. Enjoyed it very much and look forward to finishing it. I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
All the way from Napa?
Yep.
Okay. Well, thanks again for joining us. It's author Faith DeLucio and Peter Menzel, photojournalist. Together, they produced What I Eat, Around the World in 80 Diets. It has a foreword by Marion Nessel. You can learn more about that in hopefully by the end of the month, maybe by next week, whatieat.org. And, you know, see what you think about some of the food that people eat around the world. That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is a listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.